welcome to today's Cover to Cover, and I'm lucky enough to be joined on the phone by Shane Hegarty to talk about his new novel, Dark Mouth, Worlds Explode. So hi, Shane. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm not too bad, not too bad. So you've been with us before. You were here with us for the first Dark Mouth novel. So maybe do you want to tell us a little bit about the new book? How have things progressed since the first book?
So for those who don't really know the Dark Mouth story, it's about a boy who's the last in a long line of legend hunters whose job it is to protect the world from monsters of myth who invade. And the boy Finn and his father live in the last town on Earth where this happens, and it's a small town on the east coast of Ireland. And when we first met them in the first book, we kind of saw how reluctant he's 12. He doesn't really want to be going around coming close to death repeatedly at the hands of minotaurs and the like. But as we left it, it's always difficult because I like to write with cliffhangers, both within the books and kind of with a bit of a teaser at the end of the books as well. So, but he was left in a situation where he kind of had to do a lot of things on his own as it comes into the second book. So one of the things that readers really enjoyed from the first book was seeing the world in which the monsters live, because they kind of invade from their own world. So Worlds Explode takes us into that world quite a lot. And Finn and his friend Emmy and new characters, both in there and in our own world, have to face up to to all the challenges and excitement and silliness, because they're sort of adventurous books, but and fantastical books, but they're also, I hope, sort of funny books, and they have scary characters and silly characters, ridiculous characters, and all those things combined.
Yeah.
So that's a long-winded way of saying that, that Finn continues to fight monsters, but this time in their own world.
Yeah, hero's work is never done, as they say.
Never done. And because there are more books to come, it's not done yet.
Fantastic. That's what we want to hear. So how would you describe the legends in the books? If somebody wanted to... So what are these legends? Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, so they're all based on real legends of myth.
Yeah.
Or existing myths. So I like to pick things from all around. So I drop in references to the ones that we know from Greek myths, like of the Minotaur. I've got a Hydra in there, that kind of thing. But also to take from Celtic myths.
Yeah.
So there's a character, a Hogboon, which is a sort of impish Scottish myth. There are Fomorians, who come from Irish myth, kind of giants from Irish myth. And I just like to kind of take whatever I can and then adapt them. So while they may have a basis of something we're familiar with, I like to look at it and say, well, what would it actually be like to be one of these creatures?
Yeah.
And to have a bit of fun with it. So I have a creature in the second book called the Orthrus in Worlds Explode, and it has the body of a dog, but with a snake for a tail. And I kind of thought, well, what would it actually be like to be, especially that snake stuck between the back legs of a dog all your life?
Yeah,
every time
yeah.
The dog is happy, it wags its tail, you're getting dizzy, and every time it needs to go for a pee, you're being splashed on.
Yeah.
And so so that's the way it works. So I kind of like taking things from that maybe are a bit familiar in some cases and unfamiliar in others, and just having a bit of fun with them then.
Yeah, seeing it from a different perspective, I suppose.
Exactly.
One that you wouldn't necessarily even think of.
No, and it also helps me because I'm quite lazy, so I don't have to think up new monsters myself. I just take them from where they exist already and then put a twist on them.
That's not a good thing to admit to as an author, though, is it? I'm lazy.
Well, I think a lot of authors maybe are lazier than we think.
Yeah, maybe.
While there's the discipline of doing it, there's a huge amount of procrastination and messing, and the web is... gets in the way and all sorts of things as well.
Yeah, so I mean, going back in time to the, I know we spoke to you last time for the first book, but just going back in time to, for anybody that maybe didn't catch that interview, maybe hasn't read the first book, where did the idea come from for the first novel? How did it all kind of start for you?
It sort of started with this, I'd been looking for an idea. I'd written a couple of history books, popular history books, but I was really, I really always wanted to write fiction.
Mm.
And I suppose had spent years maybe as a journalist, because I worked in the Irish Times, thinking, well, fiction, I don't really have the imagination for it. You become so used to dealing with fact that the that it feels quite difficult to create something completely out of nothing. So, yeah. But just the more I thought of it, and the more I thought of it, the more I veered really towards science fiction and fantasy, which are things that I love reading, but also, I suppose, ultimately towards that sort of younger age group. I just had this idea as I was sitting on the train one day going into Dublin to work of a boy at the very end of this long chain of generation after generation after generation who had to protect a town from monsters. And that was the idea, just at its beginning, just this 12-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And it was going to be all up to him, that he would effectively be the last in a long line, not just within his family, but around the world. And it just started from that. And once I had that idea, and once I decided I would set it in a kind of a modern day, so while it has all these myths and monsters, it's actually set in a kind of recognisable town, I hope, and that kids who read it can see themselves in it, because he goes to an ordinary school and he has ordinary concerns and all that. So once I knew that, then it really kind of took off from there, and I was surprised at how, I wouldn't say easily, because that's not right, or quickly, but certainly how it spun out from there. And I found that every time I sat down to write something, the story grew and grew and grew.
Yeah.
So, but really from that very just simple idea of a boy faced with all that pressure, and just took it from there.
Yeah. So, I mean, did Finn come to you fully formed, or was he like a spark that kind of grew into a bigger thing?
You know, obviously, I don't think anything is ever fully formed, because when you sit down to write it, so much reveals itself. But certainly, he was easy for me to identify and write, because I think for a couple of reasons, a lot of us remember what it was like to be 12.
Yeah.
A lot of us know what it's like to kind of feel the pressure of doing something you don't really want to do. And as a father myself, I suppose I sort of found that I'd both seen that experience. I had this very basic idea that of taking a very familiar sight, which a lot of people see on a weekend morning in Ireland, which is of kids maybe being sort of coerced onto GAA pitches and rugby pitches and things, and they don't really want to
be there. Yeah.
By pushy dads or pushy mothers or whatever. And I would have been a bit like that as a father. You know, you find you kind of go on, it's good for you. And almost taking that to the sort of the most extreme example I could find, you know, which is obviously of a boy being pushed into fighting giant monsters. And really, once I kind of put that together, I found that I could write the character, but also identify with the character. And I have to say, the father within it as well, who is a very well-meaning, not sort of bullying father by any means, sort of well-meaning and wants to keep the tradition going and all of that, but maybe he's a bit blind to how much his son doesn't want to do it, I could identify with him as well. So I think once I had that dynamic, once I had those two characters, certainly a huge amount came out of it. And it is, all writing and all books really are about character, ultimately, because you can have a great plot and exciting action and adventure and big scary monsters, but if the reader doesn't care about the characters at the centre of it, then the book just won't work.
Exactly.
And people won't keep reading.
Yeah. So you had the character of Finn. Was that that was the first thing, and then the story came after?
I would say the two, in a way, sort of came hand to hand. I'd always had an idea that I wanted to write a story. I mean, I'm very open about this. My favourite books are The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes, classic.
Certainly the first two books in particular, that and The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. And they are just fantastic, brilliant books. And what I always loved about those was that Douglas Adams could create entire stories in a paragraph. That he would just jump out of the story and tell another story briefly and then jump back into it. And I wanted to do something similar where I could have a couple of worlds, the worlds of the humans and the worlds of the monsters, and that I would be allowed to sort of take little diversions and do little stories based on other characters, or to almost drop the reader into a world that had been existing for a couple of thousand years, so that it wasn't an origin story.
Yeah.
It was a story that sort of, that this world already was already existing.
Yeah.
Huge amounts had happened. And again, I think while the characters were there very early on, the idea of what dynamic and what challenges they would face was there from the very beginning as well. And I'm still surprised that really what was probably kind of the first proper idea I had just seemed to fly very quickly for me as a writer, and then thankfully for the reader and you know, the publishers first. So, but you do, as I said, you can have the idea for the story, but the character remains the important thing. So the trick then from there on in is making sure that everything that happens within that story reflects how the character would be, and how you know, how the reader kind of believes in what's happening.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, this is your second book now. So, did you learn anything from the first book that you did differently second time around? Was there anything you thought, oh, you know, I should have done that, and you've maybe implemented it for the second book?
Well, the main thing I learned was when I sent the first book, finished book, to the publisher.
Yeah.
To my editor, and I was probably almost literally clapped my hands and sort of, well, that's the end of that. That's great. And then got it back with, like, basically pulled apart. Very nicely, I have to say. And I then went through, we would have had about, which is fairly standard, we would have had maybe 3 or 4 drafts, really, before the final version came through. That I learned. So second time around, I would have been much more aware that one of the things when you're sending in a book to a really good editor, if you have doubts in your head about anything and you kind of think, well, I think I've got away with that, they'll say, do you know what, that's not working, and it's almost like they can kind of see into your thoughts. So certainly I found the writing amazingly interesting, the editing and all of that, because it really, the second time around, I would have had to have been a lot more careful about plotting and making sure things made sense, that you really have to have it watertight, which isn't to say that I did first time round again with this. But, and then the other thing is just getting that, I suppose, because the first book introduces the world and the characters, there's probably a little bit more action from an earlier point, maybe in the second book, where you've done a lot of that introduction. So you can say, okay, well, now we know the overall idea of these characters, so what's the challenge for this book? And I think, again, because I've just finished writing the third book, you'd see that again, you know, that it allows you to strip away a bit of that explanation and backstory, and you can just get straight into things a little bit more, even while you're trying to develop the character. But that would be certainly, I think, as with anything, the more you do it, the more you learn, and it becomes, I suppose, you become a bit more of a well-oiled engine. Yeah. And certainly I found the writing of the second book probably more enjoyable in a way than the first, because maybe just a little bit more confidence than I had first time.
Yeah. I mean, was it easier to write the second book? Did you find it flowed a bit easier? Or is it like it was the difficult second book, you know, you hear about, like, with albums and things like that?
No, I have to say, I find that once I sit down to write, I don't get writer's block.
Yeah.
Plotting is the big thing, and it's always a bit of a jigsaw puzzle, and you're trying to figure out, well, if two characters are here in chapter 3 and then you send them off in different directions and they're in completely different places by chapter 20, how do you get them back together at the end? And if you have 6 characters, how do you get them all of them back together at the end? But in terms of the writing itself, I have to say I just love when I sit down and write. The best part of writing for me is when I have a blank page and when I just start typing, because it's the only time it will ever be fresh to me. And I suppose with the second book, Worlds Explode, what was great was I was writing it knowing that it would be published. That was the other difference.
First
time, I was really writing it just to see how it would go.
Yeah.
And knowing that the second time around would be published was actually a really nice feeling. It wasn't the pressure.
A bit less pressure, exactly.
So that was great. But at the same time, I had to remember the thing that was there at the very beginning for me, which is that I was writing it for myself.
Yeah.
Writing it because I'm enjoying it. And you still have to hold on to that kind of the original reason why you sat down to write, which is purely for the enjoyment and the challenge, and just the and to do it for yourself.
Yeah,
and if nobody will ever read it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so did you have an end game for the book? How do you work? Do you start, you know, obviously where book one is going, you start on book two. Do you sort of work towards a, you know, what your end game is, or do you just sort of have a rough idea and then just go with it and see what happens?
I generally have a pretty good idea of where the story might end in a particular book, but I don't. So I'm going from A to B, but I might necessarily know where I'm going to go in between. And I do a fair amount of planning in advance, and then those plans change. And because they're books for 8 to 12-year-olds, yeah. is the official age group.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, anybody. I always like to think anybody can enjoy it. But they're very heavily, obviously very heavily plotted. There has yeah. to be, for me, a reason to go. When you reach the end of a chapter, you want to see what happens in the next
exactly.
chapter. So I tend
exactly.
to write with very very clear, almost kind of cliffhangers, almost like those old serials which that used to run when I was growing up, you know, the kind of Flash Gordon type
yes.
thing of, oh, he's driven off the edge of a cliff or whatever. and to do that, so what happens is you make the plan, but it changes as it goes along
yeah.
because it's so heavily plotted. Sometimes it can get a bit complicated, and one of the great things an editor does to say, and I have a brilliant editor, Nick Lake in HarperCollins, who's also a fantastic and prize-winning writer, he will say, that doesn't make sense, or there's too much going on there, or you don't need that. And you almost throw everything at it for a while, and then once you get past that first draft, you tend to strip away. So even though the end would be pretty much where I was always going to bring it,
yeah.
all the bits in between might have changed. And in some cases, entire characters might have disappeared or plot strands. There's one particular thing I've been trying to get into all three books that I've written so far, and I just haven't been able. Every time I do it, it just doesn't work, or it just takes up too much time.
Yeah.
So it keeps coming out. Someday I'll get this particular thing I want to get into the books in there, but it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. So here's a question for you. What do you think, personally, is more important, character or storyline?
Oh, well, I think you can have really interesting characters without necessarily having a gripping storyline.
Yeah.
Because obviously the story is, the character can be the story, if that makes
yes.
sense. I think it's very difficult to write stories that don't have interesting characters. So,
yeah.
And what I try and do in my writing is make sure that all the action arises from the characters
mm-hmm.
so that you're not just doing something for the sake of it. I mean, I've been watching a couple of things recently and it annoys me when I watch an action-packed TV show or film where you can almost literally say, hold on, there's an entire storyline there or that whole action scene that is, you could take it out and it would be the film or the TV
yeah.
show would be exactly the
yeah.
same.
Yeah.
It would just be 5 minutes shorter, but it wouldn't be any, it would have made no difference whatsoever to the story. So
yeah.
I think character for me has to be at the heart of everything. But from that, then you can still get great story and action and all of that out of it.
Very good answer. So let's go back in time. So how did it all start for you? Is writing, obviously you say you work for the Irish Times, is writing something that's kind of been a key part of your life for a long time?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So when I go and talk to readers and I visit schools or bookshops or theatres or whatever it is that I'm doing,
yeah.
and I always tell the young readers about, like, when I was 7 years old, being asked by my first class teacher to write a poem. We were all asked to do it. We wrote a poem. We had to do a few drawings with it, and it went up on the wall of the classroom. And I remember vividly that day when the poem went up, and I just thought, this is the best poem that's ever been written by anybody in the history of the world. Now, the thing is, it wasn't.
You're a modest child.
It wasn't the best poem ever written. But it was, for me, it was a switch that went off in my head,
yeah.
and I realised from that moment on that that's what I wanted to do. And I suppose it was also, I kind of felt, this is the thing I'm quite good at. And I think we all have those moments, we all need those moments. You go, do you know what, this is what I want to do. And really from that point on, it never occurred to me in any serious way about doing anything else other than writing, either as a journalist or later then obviously doing the books. And I do wonder what else, I'd be really in trouble if I had to do anything else, because I am completely talentless in any other regard.
So what would you be doing if you weren't writing?
I'm utterly incompetent. There's nothing, I could do no other job. So, yeah, so it's always been, and obviously I grew up just reading.
Yeah.
And so it's a very strange thing when you get to a point in your life, what am I now, 41, where you're allowed write and read and make books, you know,
yeah.
write stories that turn into these gorgeous
yeah.
books. And it's a very surreal and wonderful thing when you get to do it all the time. It's So for me, it just goes immediately back to when I was seven, and that's what that day when we put those poems up on the classroom wall.
Yeah.
That was the moment where I realised that's what I want to do, and every day I come down to this office where I am now, and I'm very, very grateful that I get to do it. It's amazing.
That's brilliant to know at that age. Do you know what I mean? To be so, well, not focused, but to know at that young age, you know, this is something that I really, really enjoy, and I'd love to do it when I'm older.
Yeah, and I meet so many brilliant kids,
yes,
who love, whether it's writing or reading or drawing, a huge amount of them really like drawing.
Mm.
A lot of them now really enjoy making computer games, you know, programming, things like that. And I think it's really important that they're allowed to follow that. My parents were brilliant because they never, ever said, well, you can always, it's nice that you like reading, but you really should be an accountant.
Yeah, push you towards something else. Yeah.
They never, ever told me what I had to do. They just gave, they bought me books. And I think that we all have those moments, and a lot of kids have it, especially where they sort of go, this is what I love.
Yeah.
This is the thing that I love doing. And you wish, it's lovely to see that. There's so many, especially I think at the age that I'm meeting readers at 10,
yes,
11, where there's,
yeah,
a purity to that. They just know, that's what, I just love that. I love that. And there's no cynicism about it. There's no doubt about it. And it's great when you meet teachers or parents or librarians who really guide them and allow them,
yeah,
then to act that out and to enjoy it. And that's really, I think, how what we should be doing. And obviously not all kids will end up being full-time writers or artists or whatever it might be, but they'll always have that, whatever it is that makes them tick, whatever it is that is that switch that I talk about, that switch we say, this is what I love doing. There's so many ways in which you can carry that on in your life. And so I think that's there in all of us. I've just been very, very privileged that it's something I've been able to do in adult life as well.
Yeah, no, my 10-year-old nephew, I think you signed a book for him when the first book came out. He's absolutely obsessed with the books. And when I said I was going to be talking to you today, he screamed on the phone. So I think he's looking forward to reading the second book. So,
oh, listen, they are the best. I am so lucky. One of the, and I don't want to sound cocky about it, but when you write for 8 to 12-year-olds, I honestly think I have the best readership because they are so passionate about books. They're so open about that if they enjoy them. They're so honest, which is really good as well. They ask great questions. If you go into a classroom of 10-year-olds and say, does anyone have a question, they all put their hands up. And there's no cynicism, and it's just lovely. It's lovely. So it's a fantastic age, and I always love hearing those stories.
So, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about your writing process? Going back to the whole writing thing, would you say you're quite disciplined as a writer? Do you allocate time, or how do you work normally when you're writing a book?
People say you must be very disciplined.
I know you said you were lazy earlier, so.
Yeah. No, listen, I mean, there are times when I'm very disciplined.
Yeah.
And there are times when I'm not as disciplined, yeah, as I should be. And often the proximity of a deadline is the thing that dictates how disciplined I am. Deadlines are wonderful things for putting pressure on you to actually get something done. I'm not too bad. I would, I work 9 to 5. I come down to the office every day between 9 to 5. And when I'm in the middle of writing, actually, it can be going very well.
Yeah.
But I would find generally that in terms of actual writing, it's very hard to write more than about 3 or 4 hours in that day.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Pure writing, because it'd be just your brain hurts. So often the way I think of it is I'll come down and I'll say, well, I'm going to try and write this chapter and just put a name on that. And if that chapter is, in my case, because I write quite short chapters, whether it might only be 600 words long or it might be 2,000 words long.
But yeah.
I've often found that it's great progress. So some days I might come down to the office and I mightn't get very much writing done, but it's about solving a problem within the book, and that's a good day. And then other days it's because I've written 3,000 words or whatever. But as I said, I try and come down from 9 to 5. I try and get what I can done. Sometimes fail, sometimes succeed. succeed, but I do think the discipline is important because I know people have different... I'll tell you, the one thing I have learned, which is very useful, because when I started off, I was writing on the train, I was writing in libraries, I was writing in coffee shops, is to be able to write anywhere. So that's one thing that I do, is make sure that I'm not so disciplined, if that makes sense, that I can only write in one place.
I will
bring my laptop with me, and I actually sometimes find it quite freeing to be somewhere completely different.
Different atmosphere.
Yeah. I would say the web is the worst thing. The web is the worst thing for writers, and writers are...
Distraction!
Oh, we often do, and writers will get together and they will talk about how they... I know people who hand their modems to their partners if the partner is leaving the house for work every day. I use this thing called Freedom on my Mac, which shuts off the internet for a while. The internet is definitely the enemy of discipline.
Yeah, that's the thing. In this day and age, the internet is it's crazy how time consuming it is. You only have to look at one thing, and it's kind of it steamrollers into. I'd say it must distract so many people from what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and often as well, if it's awful thing of like it's research. So I'll watch this film for research, you know, just to see how, you know, maybe I'll get some ideas from watching the Mission Impossible. But and weirdly, often that's the case. I find that I read a lot, obviously, but I also like drawing from TV and film. But sometimes you can use that as an excuse.
Why not?
I have found I've regressed as the more I work in this job, the more I've regressed in that, you know, as when you work in an office job, you feel you have, there's an onus on you to act like an adult.
Yeah.
But now I have a TARDIS on my desk. I have alien posters. My bookshelf is increasingly full of kids' books, obviously, which I really enjoy. Yeah. And I bought a Star Wars 1978 annual the other day for £1.
Cool.
£1 sterling on eBay. Because I used to have it when I was a kid, and I would have given it away years ago and regretted it. So I've completely regressed in that way now, I have to say, very happily.
Yeah, now there's a lot of that about, isn't there? Just like, you know, nostalgia is absolutely huge for, you know, for everybody at the moment.
But the other thing is, I think as an adult, sometimes we leave all that stuff behind us, all the kid stuff. And one of the joys of my job is that I get to reach back into all of those influences and all the things that excited me when I was the age that my readers are. But also, as I said, all those influences, all those things that I read and watched and listened to or whatever as I was growing up, we forget they're all still in there. They're all in our brain, ready to feed the imagination. But maybe, depending on what we all do as we get older, we kind of shut those parts away because we feel we don't really need them anymore. They're only childish things. And I get to... I suppose kind of open that door and really rummage around and see all those things like Ghostbusters and Back to the Future and whatever it might be, Roald Dahl and, you know, and the original Star Wars and all the things that really influenced me and excited me when I was young.
Yeah.
And to take them back out and kind of throw them at my own blank page and see what comes out.
Yeah. So do your kids know what Daddy does, or do you think you just lock yourself away for long periods?
No, well, I have a 10-year-old son, so he's just big into the books, and he would have been, when he read the first book, the relief when he enjoyed it, because it would have been a long few years otherwise. So he loves them, and in fact, because the third book is out at the end of March called Chaos Descent, every time it's been in the house on the computer with the computer screen open, he says, no, I don't want to see it, I don't want to see it, he doesn't want to ruin the surprise of it. And my five-year-old, so I've got four children, and I have a five-year-old, and I actually had to go in recently and do the parents come in and talk about what they do for a job.
Yeah.
So I went into her class and talked. So she always kind of knew that Daddy was an author, but I think now she sort of has an idea of exactly what I do and seems quite excited by it.
Yeah.
And I have 3-year-old twins, and they, if they're in a bookshop and they see the book, they will shout Daddy's book, which is a lovely thing, and which I really should try and use to try and sell a few more books. It's quite cute. But it's one of the joys, especially as I said, with having a 10-year-old son who loves reading. I mean, he reads and reads and reads, and... in fact, it's just picked up The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, fantastic.
Sort of quietly watching to see if he's quite at an age where he'll enjoy it. But it's lovely to have that. He's come to a couple of events with me, and so it's really nice. It's really, really nice to just have that. I suppose to have that reader, you know, reader, somebody who's really enjoying it in the house with me. Although I did read the day where he goes, "Yeah, it wasn't as good as the last one." Or worse, you say, "Yeah, God, that's for kids. They have no interest in that."
Yeah, a lot more kids that sort of age. As I said, my nephew's 10, and it kind of started when he was about 9, but he's really gotten into reading now. He's still he's off on the Xbox, you know, now and again, but
yeah.
It's still, I'm always giving him books, and he's like, "Oh, wow," and he just absolutely digests them quite quickly, so I'm quite glad that he's sort of gotten into them, you know.
But the other thing is that for all the tablets and Xboxes and all those things, and I have to say the best thing that happened in our house last year was the tablet breaking, my son's tablet breaking, because it was, we had a timer on it and all those things anyway.
Yeah,
he did,
yeah.
But he started his reading, which he was always a good reader anyway.
Yeah.
Took off. And despite all those things, though, kids still love a proper printed book.
Yeah.
And I think that's really nice. And there's nothing like going into the shop, and I think there's a bit of magic of going in with a young reader, just as there is as an adult as well, obviously. But going in, especially with a young reader, and they can pick a book.
Yes.
Or they have a choice of book, or what are they going to start on now? And it's there's such excitement there. And they look after the books, and they love them, and I think they treasure them and appreciate them in a way that, I suppose, again, as you get older, sometimes we just take these things for granted because we've been reading books for whatever amount of time. But when you're 10, 9, 10, 11, and you're really starting to get into your reading, there's just there's so much to discover. It's just it must be a wonderful time to be a reader. And the other thing we have to remember is that kids' books now, the range and the standard and the quality and
yes,
the design,
so much
and all those things,
there.
Compared to when I was growing up, and, you know, when I was over 30 years ago, when I was my son's age, it was far more limited, and the bookshops didn't have those big sections they have now, and they didn't have the design teams, and you didn't have the opportunity to meet authors.
Yeah.
So, and in Ireland, you didn't really have too many Irish authors who wrote for kids because it wasn't taken particularly seriously or whatever, or just the publishing industry wasn't geared up for it. And it's a completely different landscape now. Really exciting time to be a 9 or 10 year old reader.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you've got your Darren Shands, and you've got your Derek Landys of the world, and of course yourself. I mean, authors treated like rock stars, you know, to these kids.
It's one of the things that's very noticeable in Britain is how much they see Irish writing for
most
young people
definitely
as being a thing. As being, I think it's already obviously we're known for producing great poets and literary fiction, but it has really been noticed. The Irish element is something they're very curious about why it is that that's now transferred down to Irish writers, and there are more to come. There's guys like Dave Rudden this year, and then you have great illustrators like Niamh Sharkey or Oliver Jeffers, and there's just so many great writing by Irish authors for young people. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and talking about that, it brings me on to another thing. It's just been announced yesterday. I know I got an email from the guys at Mountains to See, and you're going to be doing some stuff in for them in March. You're going to be doing two shows for them?
Yeah, well, I'm involved in two. So I'm doing one on my own out in Dundrum, where I'll be talking about, obviously, the whole kind of world of Darkness. And at that stage, we'll be approaching the publication of the third book. So I'll probably be able to talk a little bit about that.
Fantastic.
And that's on Wednesday, the 9th of March in Dundrum. And then on the Friday, I'll be interviewing two really brilliant authors, Phil Earle, who's a great writer of a book which some kids would know called Demolition Dad. He's an English writer, and he has a new book, Superhero Street, coming out. But there's also Dave Rudden, who's an Irish guy who is fantastic, and he's got this great book coming out this year called Knights of the Borrowed Darkness, or the Borrowed Dark, and it's a series, and the beginnings of a series, and he is brilliant at reading from his books and really entertaining. So. And that's the thing. There's so many great festivals, Mountains to See.
Oh, it's an amazing
festival.
It really is.
But again, the opportunities that are there for people to go and meet writers and to hear about writing and get books signed and pictures and whatever are great. So it's a real joy to be part of it.
Yeah, yeah. You see the kids. I mean, I've been to a lot of the festivals and some of the kids' shows there, and it's just amazing. The kids are standing in line. There's about like 100 kids, and they're all standing there, all very, very well behaved, and just, you know, queuing to meet the authors and things. It's just fantastic, absolutely fantastic to see.
Well, when you see Derek, the queue for Derek Landy,
oh my God, yes.
Something to behold. And Darren Shan will be another one.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in, it's terrible now. I can't remember exactly what town it was in England, but I was in passing through, going to Waterstones in a regional town somewhere in England. And a couple of hours later, Darren Shan was going to be passing through as well. And there was somebody there sitting outside, and she had been sitting there for 4 hours already.
Oh,
even, you know, just waiting for Darren Shan. And, you know, and again, it's just when you see that that excitement and just how much that someone like Darren Shan, the books have impacted on readers' lives and how much they love them. It's wonderful to see. It's wonderful to see. And so I got a real sense of it. I won't rest until I've had somebody sleep overnight. get the sleeping bag outside Easton or something.
We'll have to get that for the next book. We'll try and get a child to sit outside and queue.
Exactly. Yes. I'll get my son to do it. He'd be very happy.
He'd be expecting payment, I'd say. What are you going to give me for doing it, Dad? He'd be like,
I think a lifetime free supply of chocolate, I think.
Yeah. So kids can obviously come and see you at these two events in March. If people want to find out, they can go to the Mountains to See website and you can book tickets now. I think tickets have gone on sale already. And I think they're doing schools. They're allowing school parties to come in as well and see the shows.
Yeah, the schools come in. Yeah, and then I'm hoping I'll be doing a couple of other... we're still waiting for... there'll be a few details to be sorted out, but I'll have a couple of other tours around Ireland between now and May. So hopefully I'll be travelling. I'll be in Dublin a lot and I'll be around the country, so I'm hoping to meet lots of young readers over the next couple of months.
Yeah, so we'll have to get some of the Northside children to head in and meet you. As I said, my nephew is just bowled over by your books, so I'm hoping
great.
I'm gonna try and get this second one signed when I see you next, hopefully.
I'd love to do that.
Thank you so much for joining us again today, Shane. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you.
No problem, Paul. I really enjoyed that. Thanks for asking me.
Cool. So Darkmouth Worlds Explode by Shane Hegarty is published by HarperCollins. So go out and get yourself a copy today. You can't miss it. It's got an amazing front cover.